Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are opening the source material on a figure who, well, has really dominated cable news for over a decade. But her foundation is maybe surprisingly academic and historically rigorous. We're talking about Rachel Maddow. We're diving into the biography of this DPhil-holding, Grammy-winning scholar who really managed to translate high-level policy research into a massive media brand.
Exactly. And our sources today, they don't just, you know, list her jobs. They reveal a very deliberate strategy. So our mission for you, the listeners, to kind of connect the dots between that intense academic background, the Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, and her, well, unconventional structure for political commentary. We want to understand the wonk behind the anchor, right? Yeah. See how that strategy let us succeed across, well, pretty much every platform. TV, radio, books, podcasts, the works.
It's pretty staggering when you look at the raw facts, the sheer scope. I mean, most people know her as the anchor of the Rachel Maddow Show. But let's just hit some immediate headlines that show her historical importance. She holds a Doctor of Philosophy in Politics from Oxford, first openly lesbian host of a major primetime news program in the U.S. And that detail that always gets me, a Grammy Award for the audiobook of her nonfiction book, Blowout.
Yeah, that combination is exactly it. Academic rigor meeting mainstream, like critical acclaim. That's what we need to unpack. This is someone who is a competitive high school athlete, volleyball, basketball, swimming.
Right.
And at the same time, reach the absolute top tier of global academic prestige. So the story isn't just about being a TV host. It's about a scholar finding the most effective way to deliver complex long-form analysis.
Okay, so let's unpack that foundation, the academic side, the personal side, because the contrasts in her background, they really seem key to understanding her later focus on things like systemic fairness and policy.
Right. So she was born in Castro Valley, California, April 1st, 1973.
Yeah.
And if you look at the family context, it's stable, solid, middle class, but definitely ideologically conservative. Her father was former U.S. Air Force, then became a lawyer. Her mother was a school program administrator.
And the sources really emphasize that the culture she grew up in was, well, a world away from the liberal circle she moves in professionally now. Her family was described as very, very Catholic, and she grew up in a community her mom called very conservative. That must have created a real tension, you know, a curious, obviously bright student in an environment where her identity, her later politics, they would have been pretty oppositional.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And Maddow herself kind of acknowledged this split in her youth. She described herself in high school as, and this is a great quote, a cross between the jock and the antisocial girl. So you have this active participation in team sports, the discipline, strategy, running parallel to this more internal, intellectual, maybe even isolated life. This balancing act seems to be a theme throughout her career. Public persona, deep internal thought.
Okay, so academically, it starts at Stanford, BA in public policy, 1994. And she got the John Gardner Fellowship at graduation, which is notable. Public policy itself, that field, it inherently connects political action with, like, measurable outcomes, right? It kind of sets the stage for her focus on policy analysis, not just political personalities.
Definitely. But Stanford is also where our sources reveal this intensely personal moment that kind of thrust her into the public eye way too early. As a freshman, the college newspaper outed her as a lesbian before she'd even had the chance to tell her parents.
Wow. That is just a staggering invasion of privacy and such a stressful way to become publicly visible, especially so young. I mean, to have something that personal published against your will, that must have created this profound sense of scrutiny she had to learn to handle, like, right away.
Yeah, and it seems she managed it by channeling that intensity inward, focusing on academics, which culminates in one of the highest achievements possible, the Rhodes Scholarship in 1995. And you really have to understand the weight of the Rhodes. It's incredibly competitive internationally. Based on intellect, leadership, character, public service. She was actually so sought after that year, she turned down a Marshall scholarship, also prestigious, to accept the Rhodes.
And it wasn't just about the academic win, was it?
No, not at all. By accepting in 95, she made history. Became the first openly lesbian winner of the Rhodes Scholarship.
Huge.
Yeah, a really key moment for LGBTQ plus visibility in those elite academic circles in the mid-90s. It showed her personal identity and intellectual power were, you know, intertwined aspects of her public success.
So the Rhodes takes her to Oxford, Lincoln College, and she starts working on a Doctor of Philosophy in Politics. She finished that in 2001. A DPhil, that's years of dedicated original research. It's like the polar opposite of the 24/7 news cycle she'd later join.
Exactly. And the title of her thesis gives you the ultimate insight into how our analytical mind works. It was HVADs and healthcare reform in British and American prisons.
Okay.
So not abstract political theory. This is deep comparative public policy analysis focused on systemic government failure, human rights abuses, all within controlled environments like prisons.
That specific topic really does explain a lot about what people call the Maddow method, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. Think about it. She chose something requiring rigorous cross-national comparison, Britain versus U.S. It involved deeply marginalized people, prisoners, and examined that intersection of politics, public health, human suffering. Her thesis wasn't just describing the problem, it was analytical, looking at where systems break down and how policy reform could fix injustice. That kind of deep evidence-based structural critique, that becomes the absolute backbone of her famous A-block analysis later on.
Okay, so here we have this DFL holder, right? Trained in policy, comparative political systems. She comes back to the States. How does someone who just spent, what, half a decade studying prison healthcare reform end up, well, behind a radio mic? It seems like a pretty unconventional jump.
It really is. And it speaks to her willingness to start small, maybe unexpectedly. It started in 1999, Holyoke, Massachusetts, at WRNX. She got her first radio job by literally winning a contest.
A contest? Seriously?
To be the second lead, like the sidekick, on the Dave in the Morning show. This Oxford academic wins a local radio contest. It suggests this natural talent for communication, for performance, that existed right alongside the academic chops.
Wow. So she did that, then hosted a big breakfast on WRSI for a couple of years, and then makes the jump to Air America in 2004, the liberal talk radio network. That was her first real taste of national political commentary, right?
Mm-hmm. Air America is where she co-hosted Unfiltered.
Yeah.
And look at the co-hosts, Chuck D from Public Enemy and Liz Winstead, who co-created The Daily Show. That's quite a lineup.
Yeah, definitely eclectic.
Even after Unfiltered got canceled in 2005, the network saw her potential. They immediately launched The Rachel Maddow Show on radio that April. And that radio show, that was really the training ground for the style she'd perfect later on TV. You know, conversational but packed with context.
The sources mention how tough that transition period was, though, especially once TV started happening.
Oh, incredibly taxing. By 2008, her TV career is taking off. And the schedule was just brutal.
Yeah.
The radio show had to be cut back. Eventually, it mostly just used audio from the previous night's TV show. She was basically producing two daily shows simultaneously.
Burning the candle at both ends.
Totally. The radio show finally ended in January 2010 when Air America itself ceased operations.
So the TV pivot, that started back in June 2005, initially as a panelist.
Yeah, on MSNBC's Tucker, which was hosted by Tucker Carlson back then.
Right. That's a fascinating little historical footnote, isn't it? Her cutting her teeth debating him.
It really is.
Yeah.
But by January 2008, she'd moved fully into being a political analyst for MSNBC, became a regular, highly valued contributor on Countdown with Keith Olbermann.
And Olbermann seems absolutely key here.
Pivotal. She started subbing for him on Countdown. That gave her national exposure as a host for the first time. She said she was nervous doing those early shows.
I bet.
But the performance clicked. The episode she hosted was the highest-rated news program in that key 25-54 demographic. Olbermann saw that success and really pushed for her to get her own show.
And that advocacy worked. Led directly to the launch of The Rachel Maddow Show, TRMS, on TV, August 2008.
Yep. It replaced Verdict with Dan Abrams in that competitive 9 p.m. slot.
And this launch, it wasn't just a schedule change. It felt like a real watershed moment in media.
Absolutely. She became the first openly gay or lesbian host of a primetime news program in the U.S. That significantly boosted LGBTQ plus visibility nationally right at a critical time.
And the success wasn't slow, was it? It was immediate.
Immediate and, yeah, explosive. Within just 1 month, TRMS doubled the audience for that time slot. Doubled it. She was even occasionally beating Countdown in the ratings sometimes.
Yeah.
It proved her unique style, that blend of intellectual depth and engaging delivery, really resonated. People were hungry for something more than the usual cable news back and forth.
And the critics noticed, too.
Oh, yeah. Initial reviews were really positive. One outlet called her the star of America's cable news, described her as a liberal spark plug.
Yeah.
She brought a depth, a connection to history that cable news had arguably been missing, linking the day's news to that longer arc. Okay, so this is where we really get into the nuts and bolts, the intellectual machinery behind the show. It's crucial for understanding her success and why she could pivot later. Maddow has this clearly stated mission to increase the amount of useful information in the world. Simple, but powerful.
And that philosophy really shows up most clearly in her signature opening segment, the A-block. For anyone listening who isn't familiar, this A-block, it can run for, like, 20 minutes, sometimes even longer. It functions almost like a mini documentary, or frankly, like a chapter from that DPhil thesis we talked about. It just digs deep into one story, laying out all the historical, political context.
It's the core of her method. And the key difference is, she rarely just focuses on the latest tweet or the immediate outrage, right? Instead, she connects whatever's happening now to events from decades ago, uses archival clips, documents, old news reports, builds this intricate web of context. It's like investigative history packaged as a news segment.
And she sees that as essential. She said the pressure is always to deliver something to say that people don't already know. She's not just summarizing the news feed. She's trying to add intellectual value, context you can't get just by scrolling. The pacing is deliberate, the tone analytical, the commitment to history is just unwavering.
You really saw this during her coverage of the Trump administration, which, you know, often got criticized for focusing heavily on complex investigations. But her stated rule for covering that period was simple. Don't pay attention to what they say. Focus on what they do.
Right. Action over rhetoric.
Exactly. It let her filter out the noise of daily pronouncements and focus instead on policy changes, legal moves, investigations, the actual doing.
Now let's talk about how she identifies herself politically, because this often gets kind of flattened out or mischaracterized. She describes herself as undoubtedly a liberal, okay? But then she adds this really specific historical layer, saying she's in almost total agreement with the Eisenhower-era Republican Party platform.
That reference is so telling, isn't it? It suggests her ideology is rooted in things like, well, traditional government competence, strong infrastructure, national defense, positions that kind of transcend today's partisan lines. She seems to see herself supporting more classic model of American governance.
And that focus on governance, on security, explains why she calls herself a national security liberal and a defense policy wonk. Her political positions often seem driven by this deep dive into policy mechanics. Like her opposition to the 2003 Iraq War, she focused her analysis on the evidence, or lack thereof, and the sort of campaign of deception that led up to it. Analysis first, then the position.
Right. And similarly, her stance on the alleged Trump-Russia connections, it was viewed through that national security lens. Our sources confirm her view. If the presidency is found to be knowingly the product of a foreign intelligence operation, that is a full-stop national crisis.
Yeah.
She framed it not just as political drama, but as an existential threat to the integrity of government, which is totally consistent with her policy background.
Now, this kind of intense, conviction-driven commentary inevitably led to conflict. And there was a really crucial legal challenge involving One American News Network, OAN.
Yes, July 2019, OAN sued Maddow, Comcast, MSNBC, NBC Universal, the whole group, for $10 million.
And the basis for the suit was a comment Maddow made describing OAN as paid Russian propaganda.
Right. And that comment referenced a specific story in the Daily Beast, which reported that an OAN employee was also working for Russia's Sputnik News. OAN claimed this was defamation, that it hurt their reputation.
Okay, so let's dive into the legal outcome here, because it's important. The case was dismissed in 2020, and that dismissal was upheld on appeal in 2021. The judge's reasoning is key. The court found a Maddow statement was legally considered an opinion, not a factual assertion, and therefore couldn't be the basis for defamation.
Yeah, this is a huge distinction for anyone in political commentary. Defamation usually needs proof that a factual statement was made maliciously and was false. By ruling that paid Russian propaganda was opinion based on that verifiable report about the Sputnik News employee, the court essentially validated her right to draw sharp analytical conclusions from reported facts.
So pointed commentary, protected speech.
Exactly. The statement, while definitely harsh, was ruled protected hyperbole and commentary, not meant to be taken as literal fact.
That legal win basically affirmed the boundaries of her Maddow method, right? Confirmed she could use strong context-based language derived from evidence. And the kicker for OAN, Herring Networks, their parent company, had to pay Maddow's legal fees.
Ouch. Now, following all this, we see a really interesting career shift start to happen. She took a hiatus, February to April 2022, to work on the film adaptation of her first big podcast hit, Bagman.
Right. And then, crucially, since May 2022, she moved to just doing the TV show once a week on Mondays. That felt like a huge pivot. Prioritizing these long-form, deeply researched projects, which are also highly profitable intellectual property, over the daily cable news grind.
It did. Although the sources note a strategic return planned. She's announced she'll go back to five nights a week from January to May 2025. Specifically to cover the first 100 days of a potential second Trump presidency.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, so she'll revert back to Mondays after that. It shows that while long form is a priority, she still sees the need for that daily presence during really intense political periods. And that pivot to weekly TV really just underscores this transformation. Maddow has successfully become, well, a multi-platform mogul. Her writing, her audio investigations, they're winning awards usually reserved for the absolute highest levels of journalism and even the recording industry.
Let's track the writing career. First book, Drift: The Unmooring of American Military Power, came out in 2012, focused on the military's expanding role in American politics after World War II, and boom, straight to number one on the New York Times bestseller list for hardcover nonfiction.
Right, proving that DPhil-level research could absolutely be translated for a mass market.
Then came Blowout in 2019. That one was about corrupted democracy, Russia, and the global oil industry. Deep dive into energy corruption.
And this is where that unique cross-platform recognition kicks in. She recorded the audiobook herself.
And won a Grammy for it.
Exactly. Best spoken word album at the 63rd Grammys in 2021.
You know, the Grammy win isn't just a fun trivia point. It really validates her delivery as part of her success. That category celebrates narrative quality, performance. Winning it showed she could hold engagement, translate the rigor of her writing into a compelling listening experience. Put her alongside other major figures who mastered spoken word.
Totally. And her publishing success kept rolling.
Yeah.
Bagman came out as a book in 2020, co-written with Michael Yarvitz, then prequel, An American Fight Against Fascism in 2023, which grew directly out of her podcast work.
Okay, so let's talk about that podcast pivot, because arguably this is the purest expression of her long-form historical A-block method, just in a different medium. Bagman, launched in 2018, six-part investigation into the 1973 Spiro Agnew scandal, focused, historical, deeply contextualized, just like the A-blocks.
And the recognition it got immediately set it apart from, you know, typical celebrity chat podcasts. Bagman won the 2020 Alfred DuPont Columbia University Award. And for listeners, you need to know, the DuPont is widely considered the broadcast equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize.
Wow, that's serious journalism hardware.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
Winning that showed her audio work met the highest standards, the kind usually associated with PBS documentaries or major investigative teams.
And that critical acclaim instantly opened doors in Hollywood, right?
Immediately. A film adaptation of Bagman was announced. Ben Stiller attached to direct. Lorne Michaels, Mr. SNL himself, attached to produce. Clear proof that this detailed, historically grounded content is really valuable IP for mainstream entertainment.
And then she did it again in 2022 with Ultra.
Yep, Ultra. Chronicled U.S. right-wing extremism during the 1940s, World War II, focusing on the 1944 sedition trial. Again, not just pop history, forensic analysis of political movements and structures.
And again, the major awards followed. Ultra won the 2023 Hillman Prize for Broadcast Journalism.
And what's significant here historically is that it was the first time the Hillman Prize, which honors journalism fostering social and economic justice, had ever gone to a podcast.
First time ever.
Yeah. Confirming her audio format was being recognized for its depth and social impact, not just its popularity.
And predictably,
Hollywood came calling again. Steven Spielberg's company, Amblin Entertainment, optioned the film rights to Ultra late in 2022.
Spielberg.
Right. So what you're seeing is the DPhil method becoming this massive, profitable content engine. Her TV show provides the visibility and, frankly, the funding for these high-level historical research projects, which then get turned into films by A-listers.
And just for a fun detail that kind of loops back to her love of structure and synthesis, she co-wrote a New York Times crossword puzzle in 2018.
Yes.
Which she called the pinnacle of my existence. Whether it's an argument about oil or a puzzle grid, it's kind of the same task, right? Organizing complex info into a satisfying, solvable structure. Okay, so with this level of prominence, she obviously attracts both intense loyalty and really sharp criticism. That contradictory public image, it's almost part of the brand itself.
Definitely. On one side, you have immense praise for her intellectual approach. Time magazine called her a whip-smart, button-cute lefty, radiating essential decency, praised for delivering news with agenda, but not hysteria. Her fans really appreciate that deep analytical effort she puts into every single segment.
But then on the other side, critics often accuse her of acting like a lockstep party member or maybe a smug cable partisan. I remember the editors of the New Republic back in 2011 included her among their most overrated thinkers, saying her show demonstrated the intellectual limitations of a perfectly settled perspective.
And that dual perception, it really highlights a fundamental challenge in media today, doesn't it? When you apply rigorous analysis, people who disagree with the conclusion often just dismiss the analysis itself as biased partisanship. But her visibility isn't just political, it's cultural too. Her impact on LGBTQ plus visibility is undeniable. Recognized multiple times by magazines like Out and The Advocate for her prominence as an openly queer public figure.
Shifting to her personal life, the sources mention she lives with her partner, the artist Susan Mikola. They met back in 1999, apparently while Maddow was deep in her dissertation research.
Yeah, and they split their time between Manhattan and West Covington, Massachusetts. So balancing that intense media world with a more rural, quiet life.
One of the really important aspects of her public persona is her openness about mental health.
Yes, very important. She's been incredibly transparent about coping with cyclical depression since she was a teenager. She's noted that while it's something she manages daily, it doesn't diminish her capacity for joy or her ability to succeed at a very high level.
And that disclosure carries a lot of weight, doesn't it?
Huge weight. She said she felt a responsibility to share her story, because learning about others who were successful despite dealing with depression had been really vital for her own journey.
So that act of sharing turns a private struggle into a kind of public service, which really aligns with the ethos of her academic work on suffering and systems.
The sources also give us a peek into how she deliberately manages the immense pressure. She lists three key things for staying sane: exercise, sleep — she calls herself a good sleeper — and fishing.
Fishing, okay.
Yeah. It points to this grounded, disciplined approach to maintaining health in a ridiculously demanding job. We also know she's a practicing Catholic, and medically she had surgery in 2021 to remove a cancerous skin growth from her neck, which was successful.
And finally, she's undeniably a pop culture staple now, which just shows her broad reach. I mean, being impersonated multiple times on Saturday Night Live by people like Tracy Ullman, Abby Elliott, Melissa Villaseñor, that's a certain kind of arrival.
It is. And she plays along too, right? She's appeared as herself in scripted shows like House of Cards on Netflix and the movie Red, White, and Royal Blue. And maybe the ultimate example of her versatility, she voiced the fictional news anchor Vesper Fairchild in the Batwoman TV series, lending her very distinctive voice and persona to a whole different fictional universe.
Okay, so if we pull all this together, Rachel Maddow's career really feels like a masterclass in intellectual translation. We started with that academic foundation, competitive athlete, conservative background, then becomes the first openly lesbian Rhodes Scholar, earns a DPhil from Oxford doing intense comparative policy analysis on tough subjects like prison health.
Right. And that rigor wasn't left behind in academia. It became the absolute core of her media brand. It fueled her quick rise from local radio to primetime TV anchor. And crucially, she translated that academic method, the deep context, the history, the evidence, into a repeatable, successful media structure, that signature A block.
And that methodological consistency seems to be what enabled the pivot to becoming this multi-platform mogul we see now. She leveraged her TV authority to become a number one New York Times bestselling author, won a Grammy for her narration, and then developed these high-level investigative podcasts, Bagman and Ultra.
And those podcasts didn't just get popular. They won the DuPont and the Hillman Top Journalism Awards and got immediately optioned by Hollywood giants like Spielberg and Stiller.
It's incredible.
Her success really shows the power of that deep, context-driven research. So for you, the listener, the takeaway might be that intense intellectual investment doesn't have to limit your options. It can actually provide the ultimate foundation. She successfully turned her, you know, intense curiosity and policy wonkiness into critically acclaimed, highly profitable IP across pretty much every modern media format.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for today. As journalism, as news consumption keeps changing so rapidly, moving away maybe from just daily punditry, is this long-form, historically contextualized A-block method the future? You know, the method she's now adapted into these high-value, award-winning podcasts and books is that the template for how highly informed public figures will share complex information going forward. Is the DPhil-level investigation but packaged as compelling entertainment the next great medium for serious intellectual engagement? Something to think about as you navigate the news yourself.